All right, let's turn to page 350, 351. Can somebody read my voice is a little shot, so.
Speak to the entire assembly of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they shall take for themselves each man a lamb or a kid for each father's house, a lamb or a kid for the household. But if the household will be too small for a lamb or a kid, then he and his neighbor who is near his house shall take according to the number of people. Everyone according to what he eats shall be counted for the lamb and kid, or kid. An unblemished lamb or kid, a male, within its first year, shall it be for you. From the sheep or the goats you shall take it. It shall be yours for examination until the 14th day of this month. The entire congregation of the assembly of Israel shall slaughter it in the afternoon. They shall take some of its blood and place it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they will eat it. They shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted over the fire, and matzos with bitter herbs they shall eat. With bitter herbs they shall eat it.
Okay. Keep going.
You shall not eat it partially roasted or cooked in water, only roasted over fire. Its head and its legs with its innards. You shall not leave any of it until morning. Any of it that is left until morning you shall burn in the fire. So you shall eat it. Your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, you shall eat it in haste. It is the Pesach offering to Hashem.
Two more lines.
I shall go through the land of Egypt on this night, and I shall strike every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from man to beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I shall mete out punishment. I am Hashem. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are. I shall see the blood, and I shall pass over you. There shall not be a plague of destruction upon you when I strike in the land of Egypt.
Okay. So here we have an interesting mitzvah, the mitzvah of Karban Pesach, of the Paschal sacrifice. What's the context here? When is this happening?
Just before the 10th plague.
Just before the 10th plague. So we're in between the 9th and the 10th plague. And as part of the process of the 10th plague, they're going to... they're going to have to sacrifice this animal. And then, what are they going to do with the blood?
Put it in the posts.
And what will therefore happen?
God will pass.
Right, God will...
When he gives the plague to the Egyptians.
Right, so God will pass over the... will pass over the houses of the Jews and only smite the Egyptians. Now... this becomes a pretty central part of the story of the holiday of Pesach, right? So much so that it becomes the name of the holiday, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't get more central than that. So when we're talking about the Karban Pesach, we're talking about really the most core components of what this Chag, of what this Yantiv is all about. What's strange about it is that we don't do it today, right? It's very rare that we have such a central component of a Jewish holiday that we only do at certain times and places, right? We only do this in the temple, right? In Yerushalayim, at the base of Mikdash, in the temple. Now, there are things that are different about our holidays because we don't have the temple. And every Chag has certain karbanos, certain sacrifices that would be brought in the base of Mikdash, right? And there are some things we do differently because we don't have the base of Mikdash. Certainly on Sukkot, things were, there's certain rituals, certain mitzvah that were done in the base of Mikdash that we don't do today. But we don't have any other example quite like this, where we take a central element of the story, a central mitzvah to the day itself, and we say, if there's no base of Mikdash, we don't do it. There's no equivalent to this. It's like saying, there's no base of Mikdash, so we're not going to blow shofar Rosh Hashanah. There's no base of Mikdash, so forget no Seder this year. You might as well just throw away the Chag, right? That's what it would seem like. And yet, the one example where that doesn't seem to be the case is for this mitzvah, the mitzvah of the Karban Pesach. So that's the first question we're going to start off with today, is how could it be that we have a mitzvah that's so central to the entirety of the Chag, we name the holiday after the Karban Pesach, and yet, without the base of Mikdash, forget, we don't do the mitzvah. Why would Hashem set up the mitzvah that way? It seems
But it seems like a mistake. Decision?
But we're not in Egypt anymore.
Tommy? First ladies first, number two. She spoke first, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Who made the decision that we weren't going to do this without the Beit HaMikdash? Because it doesn't say here.
So you're right. We're not going to see everything. We're not going to see every. But basically, every sacrifice, every carbon, was limited to being done in the Beit HaMikdash. And this is one of those. So therefore, it falls into that category of things that can only be done in the Beit HaMikdash.
But this sacrifice wasn't done.
So that's what's unique about it. This is a sacrifice that was done and commanded by Hashem to do before we had both the Mishkan, which we used in the desert, or the Beit HaMikdash. So you're right. We'll see. We're going to go through some examples that show how this is, in some ways, it is a carbon, but in some ways has its own rules that don't apply to pretty much any other carbon, any other sacrifice. So it's a very interesting mitzvah. It's very unique in and of itself. Yes, Tommy?
We're not in Egypt anymore. And we don't have to, Hashem don't have to look in the halls and pass.
Okay.
But
so therefore what?
Therefore we don't need to put the lamb blood on the doorpost.
But we don't do that. That doesn't become part of the mitzvah. That's interesting is that certain aspects of this story we end up doing in the future, and certain aspects we don't. So we end up keeping the sacrifice, the carbon Pesach, and we bring that. But what we don't do, we do not take into perpetuity the second commandment they have to take the blood and put it in the doorpost. At no point in Jewish history after this day do Jews put blood on their doorposts.
Okay.
Right? We don't. That's a one-time deal. And that's another interesting part of this. Why do we take some parts of the story and that becomes a mitzvah for future generations, but we don't take everything? Specifically, we don't take the blood in the doorpost. Right? Which is a pretty central component to the story. Right? That's a big part of it. That's the part we remember the most. I still remember as a kid watching the Ten Commandments. And that Joshua, right? Oh, that's a Joshua, right? He's... Jews never look like that, right? He's all oiled up and strong and whatever, right? And he's taking it.
You haven't seen me then, I was 20.
All right, so Tom actually will bring pictures of himself when he's 20 so he can confirm that he looked like Joshua in that movie. There's no way that was played by a Jewish actor. There's no way half... There's none of them are Jewish actors. There's no way. There's no way.
There were Jewish actors in it.
Oh, yeah? The extras?
No, what's his name?
Charles Hessen's not Jewish.
No,
He's definitely not Jewish.
I can't think of Edward G. Robinson.
Who did he play?
I don't know which part he played.
He
was one of the people who danced around.
No, he was a bad guy.
Was he Pyro?
No, he didn't. He was the one who liked the Jewish girls. And he was
the one who wanted.
I haven't seen
the
in so many years.
Cuff.
He wanted a what?
Or Dawson or Verum. Yeah. Dustin Olvera?
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie in so long. Anyway.
He wanted to go back to Egypt. He revolted. He wanted to go
back to Egypt. Oh, I see.
Dustin.
Dustin. Uh-huh.
He played a central role.
Okay, fine. Anyway, so I can still picture that, you know, it was Joshua who would go around and people didn't want... There's this girl he liked and she didn't want to put the blood on the doorpost and he was going to make sure she... So he did it for her. Did this whole fight. So, anyway, that's a very central part of this story is the blood in the doorpost, and that doesn't stand for perpetuity. So, two questions we're starting off with. Number one, why is it that we have this mitzvah that's so central to the day of to the holiday, and yet it doesn't last for perpetuity? We only do it when we have the Beit HaMikdash. We only do it in Yerushalayim. We don't do it outside. It seems to be a very limited way to create the mitzvah.
It had a limited purpose.
Well, somebody has to understand the purpose to understand why it's limited.
If I kept reading, it says, "This day shall become a remembrance to you, and you shall celebrate it as a festival."
Mm-hmm.
It said a remembrance, not a reenactment. So,
okay,
it's implying that the commandment is to remember the Pesach as opposed to reenacting it.
You're saying that's why we don't do all the aspects of the story?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, we'll get to
but
that.
But we are good reenacting. In fact,
we do. That's the purpose of the Pesach.
Right. It's interesting.
Seder.
Right. Of all mitzvot that we have, the Pesach Seder is the most like a reenactment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? Yeah. Of any other. So much so that there's a lot of. I mean, there's all sorts of customs, but you go to Seder is where there's a mitzvah to reenact certain parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
actually even more
whipping
than
each other and doing all sorts of things.
We're supposed to actually relive it, not
right.
just reenact.
Right, exactly. You're supposed to view yourself like you're leaving Egypt. Right, of all mitzvah that we have, right, and on Sukkot, we commemorate living in the you know, we commemorate how they lived in the desert by living in a sukkah. But we're not putting sand on the floor, right? We're not like, you know, we're not I don't know, eating with our hands, right? We just have the sukkah. What?
Dying from thirst.
Right, exactly. So we're not doing that. We don't all go to, you know, to Brazil or, you know, to the equator and, like, you know, get to the hottest place we can find to live in a desert for 8 days. Right? We don't do that, right? We just, is that good? That's where equator is. The equator is in Brazil, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't do that, right? What do? We, you know, we build a sukkah. It's commemorating it, right? But Pesach is the one chag where we go out of our way to really reenact it as much as we can. So this would be the one time where the question probably is most apropos, but, you know, but you're certainly approaching it correctly. All right, let's talk about a few of the other idiosyncrasies of this mitzvah. And many of them are laid out here or alluded to in the psukim. Okay. This is also, so we're talking about how this is a different type of sacrifice. This is the only sacrifice we have that commemorates an event. Right? All the other sacrifices that we have, all the other karbanot, have a more broad purpose. Right? There's some we offer for Thanksgiving. There's some that we offer because a person sinned and they want to offer a sacrifice for forgiveness. Certain things, you know, that's usually the theme of a sacrifice, of a karban, is kind of a broader theme that applies to a lot of different people in a lot of different circumstances. Like I said, there are certain times when they would bring a specific, you know, on Yom Kippur, for example, the Kohen Gadol would offer a specific sacrifice that only he'd offer, you know, once a year. But it didn't commemorate an event. It was just Hashem lays out, do this one this time, do this one that time, a bull here, you know, a bird here, you know, like going through all the different types of sacrifices. The Karban Pesach is the only sacrifice we have, the only karban we have, where it commemorates an event, right? We had this event, and we're going to reenact it, we're going to reenact it, or relive it, or remember it, and so however you want to understand it, in the future. So that also makes it unique. That's number one. Yeah.
Is this a sacrifice?
Well, if it has to be brought in the Beis HaMikdash, if it's offered there, if it's slaughtered there, and it follows the rules of a sacrifice, it's a sacrifice.
But in the context of the story, it's not a sacrifice.
So
if you shall slaughter it, it doesn't really say sacrifice. I mean, you're not placing it on an altar. You're not doing anything.
That's true. That's a good point.
Preparing dinner.
A good point.
But it's not just a meal, because it's an entire congregation. She'll do it, so it feels more of a community thing than just cooking a meal at home.
Yeah, it's a commandment. They're commanded to eat it in a specific way, but there's rules here, right? It has to be roasted and not cooked. They have to eat it as a, you know, as a group, as a family. So there's a lot of different things to this. So yeah, it's not quite a karban. You're right, it's not quite a karban. It's later in the future it becomes a karban. That's a good point. But it also makes it interesting is that it's commemorating an event that, you're right, itself wasn't the karban, which makes sense because there wasn't a base that made this shit, so why would they be offering karbans? You're right. That's a good point. Okay. Next. This is the only karban that there's a... This is the most severe karban that if you could do it and don't, the punishment is the most severe. There's only two mitzvot.
How do we know that?
So that gets learned out in the Gemara from the psukim here. Basically, you have two mitzvot that are positive mitzvot that if you don't do them, you receive kares, which is the second highest level of punishment. Typically, the higher level punishments are for when you do or don't do, right? When you eat something you're not supposed to eat, if you steal, if you kill, if you do something that, you know, if you break Shabbos, you're told not to do something and you do it, that's usually seen as worse than not doing something you're supposed to do, right? Because then you've actively done something wrong. If you just passively don't do something, if you go through all of Sukkot and don't shake a lulav, so you missed an opportunity to do a mitzvah. But it's not quite the same. It's not nearly the same as violating something actively that you're not supposed to do, right? However, there's two exceptions to that rule. Number one is the Karban Pesach, and number two is a Brit Milah, right? The second mitzvah in the Torah. That if you don't have a Brit Milah, you don't give your son one, and then you don't get one during your own life. So then, you know, once you're old enough to do it, to take care of yourself, and you still don't get a Brit Milah, so then it's the same level of punishment. So that's also unique. It's kind of raised up as being more important, more severe. And then we have a lot of other very interesting... So the mitzvah of Karban Pesach is not just one mitzvah. It's actually fascinating how many mitzvot it is. Because when you open up the Sefer HaChinuch, the book that we're mostly using to lay out the mitzvot, it lists a number of them. So there's the offering of the Karban Pesach. Then there's the fact that it has to be tzli, it has to be roasted. Roasted like, you know, barbecued. And not cooked in water. It has to be eaten with a group or a family, typically a family. You're not allowed to have the leftovers, right? And it has to be eaten that night. You're not allowed to leave anything over to the next day to eat it. If you eat it the next day, you violated a commandment. You're not allowed to break the bones of the Karban Pesach. It has to remain whole.
What if it's on accident?
Do your best not to do it. You know, but you have to be very careful about it. When they would offer the sacrifice, I mean, they would burn it rather than break it. And there's a whole process they would go through to make sure it wouldn't break. Who can eat it? You have to have a bris milah to eat it. That was also one of the commandments. So you couldn't have eaten it unless you had a bris milah. And a number of different things. So there's all these idiosyncrasies, all these specific mitzvot that relate to this one mitzvah that is, you know, it really makes it a very big deal. Also, it's eaten a la soveya. It's eaten at the end of the meal, right? Now, this comes up today when it comes to the afikomen, right? There's an interesting discussion about the role of the afikomen. But the afikomen is supposed to be in commemoration of the Karban Pesach. We ate it at the end of the meal. So nowadays we eat matzah instead of the Karban Pesach. Okay? Now, anybody who's eaten matzah is eating the afikomen at the end of the Seder can tell you it's not always the most satisfying experience. Right? You've eaten a lot of matzah, then you ate dinner, and now you eat more matzah. It's not what you're in the mood for typically, right? You're typically like, okay, you know, it's like, you know, one more go, and then we'll get this over with.
That's the idea.
What?
You're supposed to OD on matzah.
You're supposed to OD on matzah?
OD.
But the funny thing is, it's not about matzah, right? We're doing this in order to commemorate the Karban Pesach. Once we no longer have the Karban Pesach, so we recognize that we're missing a central component of the Seder. So what do? We get more matzah, right? Now, what would make more sense? What should we have instead?
Make a plan.
Yeah, have meat, right? Chocolate cake, right? You can have that
chocolate
too.
Lamb. Chocolate lamb.
Chocolate lamb, right? Why don't we have more lamb, right? Why don't we just roast lamb and eat it at the end of the Seder, and we say this commemorates the Karban Pesach that there used to be. It makes a lot more sense than matzah, right? Matzah doesn't... How is that going to remind you of the Karban Pesach? Not only do we not do that, but there's a pretty strong custom that many people have, and the Rambam says that some have, some don't have, but many communities have, to not have any roasted meat the night of the Seder. To not eat roasted meat the night of the Seder, to only have cooked meat. Because we don't want to make it look like we do have the Karban Pesach when we don't. It's a very strange thing that we actually would go so far out of our way to make sure we don't think we have it. We know we don't have it. Right? We're living in San Francisco, right? There's no basic mikdash around. I'm pretty sure. Right? who's going to make this mistake, right? So not only do we not use meat to commemorate the Karban Pesach, but we use matzah instead, but we go so far to not even have roasted meat at the Seder.
But yeah. Some of the Passover like plates, you put the little neck of the...
The shank bone.
The shank bone. I thought this that was...
In to a certain extent, yes. Yeah, but we don't eat it. Right, we don't eat it throughout the Seder, right? So this is, we don't eat roasted, we don't eat roasted meat.
So isn't that the reminder then, looking at the bone?
A little bit, but the matzah ends up being kind of the main reminder that we have. The Seder plate's an interesting thing because it's not, but you know, it's commemorating to a certain extent, but it's not nearly as important as the afikoman. You're eating it; it's not really something you look at, but like. It doesn't play a central role as the afikoman. Yeah.
I think the matzah is one of the... Ever since I was a kid, which was a long time ago, I remember when we went to school and things were not that good. You couldn't openly have religion. And the biggest thing was how to get the matzah to home. And practically there was a black market for the matzah.
I'm sure.
And there was no matzah, so people did the best they could. And that was the biggest symbol of the dinner.
I can imagine. Yeah. So we take it for granted that we have too much matzah, that's for sure. Okay. So I want to start to kind of piece this together a little bit. So we start off with the two kind of big picture questions. But then when you look at all these little idiosyncrasies of the Karban Pesach, let's see if we can kind of understand what this is all about. Okay. So when we look at how they're supposed to eat the Karban Pesach, let's go to Pasuk Chet, verse 8. It says, Ve'achlu et ha-basar ba-layla hazeh, tzli esh u-matzot al-morim yochluhu. They shall eat the flesh on that night, roast it over the fire, and matzos with bitter herbs shall they eat it. So how are we supposed to eat the Karban Pesach?
With matzah and bitter herbs.
Matzah and bitter herbs, right? Kind of like we do now with the... now with the charoset, we have the sandwich. No. Okay, so we have three major components of this particular commandment, and really the Seder in general. We end up saying the three major things of the Seder are Pesach, matzah, and maror. Okay? Mm-hmm. Pesach, matzah, and maror. So I want to just kind of paint a picture that these three things are working in unison. Right? It's not a coincidence that Hashem is asking them to eat this meat with these two other things. Okay? They're supposed to combine to form a certain symbolism. Why not just eat the meat by itself? So, what does a maror represent?
Bitterness,
right? Our bitter lives, okay? And there's not really any, not a whole lot of ambiguity with maror, right? Maror is pretty straightforward. You know what it is, it hits you in the face. This is the bad times.
Looks like mud.
What?
Looks like mud.
Well, it depends what kind you have.
Unless it's purple mud.
Charos is the mud. Charos is the mud. Oh. Maror is the bitter herbs, yeah. Okay. Now, what does matzah represent?
Leaving Egypt.
Okay, so one sense it represents leaving Egypt.
It's what we baked on our backs when we left Egypt.
Okay, so it's...
But we haven't gotten there yet.
We haven't gotten there yet. Well, we're not going chronologically now, so we can skip around. Before we went to the night. Okay, so in one sense that we had to leave Egypt in a hurry, right? Which not only are we leaving Egypt, but the Egyptians are kicking us out. They want us out so quickly, right? Which is, that's how miraculous it is. You think we'd have to leave in the dead of night. We'd have to sneak out. We'd have to force our way out. The last thing we'd expect is that the Egyptians would usher us out and say, get out of here already, right? We're their slave labor. Who's going to do that, right? Think about what it took in America to get the slaves freed. It was not a simple process. And the people who owned slaves were not just saying, oh, get out of here, guys. You know, it's been long enough. Right? So that's one side of it. But there's a second side of matzah. the flip side, if you will. Right? And on the flip side of matzah is also bitter lives. Right? It's the poor man's bread. Right? It's called lechem oni. It's, okay. It's considered poor. We call it lechem oni. It's the poor man's bread. It's something you break, right? Why don't we break the matzah, right? And put away for later. Because that's what a poor person does. They never know where the food's going to be coming from, right? So matzah has a dual connotation. It's in one sense, it's representing the good side that we're leaving Egypt, but it also represents the rough side. It's not fancy. It's not pleasant. It's a poor person's bread. It's something that you break and save for later. Okay, so maror is unambiguous. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's unambiguous. It's the bitter side. Matzah has both going at the same time. So what does that leave us for the Korban Pesach?
Weeping.
Right, Korban Pesach is purely the leaving side. It's the good times. Right? Good times. So, that's how they're all balancing each other. So as we're eating these three things together, we're combining the entire experience into one. We have the good side, all on its own, and the Pesach and the meat, right? We have the maror, the bad side all on its own. We have the matzah, which is really doing both things at once. Okay. Now, since this is the Korban Pesach, this is what it's about, that's going to reflect itself in the way we do the mitzvah. So for example, why do we roast it? So again, we learn, and all the commentaries point out, because roasting is considered, you know, what are the best types of meat? Right? What's the most expensive types of meat?
Roasted.
Right? A steak. What do you do with a steak? Right?
You grill it.
Grill a steak, right?
It also smells good when you roast it.
It smells good, it tastes good, it, right? You grill a steak. You don't put a steak in the oven, right? You kidding me? I mean, a minute steak.
It's a pot roast.
Pot roast. You're not going to boil a steak. You're not going to cook a steak in the oven, right? No. Your best meats, you're going to grill them, right?
That's also, you're cooking the whole animal.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to put it on a steak and grill it.
Not for sure. But it's seen as kind of the highest level, the most, you know, like
of
a
taste.
Of taste, it's the most, yeah, you know, the most expensive meats, you know.
Sort of like a level of freedom.
Right, it's a level of freedom. We're living like a king. Right, you're living like a king. You can go out for a nice, you know, going out for a nice dinner. What do you say? We're going out for a steak dinner. We're going out to the steakhouse. Right, that's where you're going. Heck, in a hamburger. Right, you're going out to the steakhouse. You're going to eat. It's going to be grilled. It's going to be good, and it's going to. And I want to see the fire marks on that steak, right? I want to see it. You know, I want to see it and touch it and feel it. Why? Because that's the ultimate sign of freedom. That's
also
the way
you cook it outside. You can't grill anything really inside appropriately. You can't roast something on a fire inside, really, right?
On a spit, you can.
You can.
On a spit,
they make indoor grills.
Yeah,
and spits that you can so. You, My mother had one. It's like,
but there's definitely something to the grill.
Because I don't know if I cheated, but I've read a little, and it says that Hashem told them to use a lamb because actually it was considered like an Egyptian deity.
Right.
So kind of, I don't know, making an assumption, like because it was freeing to cook, like separating themselves from the Egyptians.
Right.
Now, so I'm cooking it outside, it was making more
of
a statement.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. That's
how about if somebody doesn't like lamb?
Then they get a goat.
Huh?
Have you ever had goat?
Well, get
I don't like it because I can smell it.
We'll get something you like, I promise. When the basic myth is just here, Tommy, we'll find something you like. Alright, we'll find something you like, I promise. So the idea is that it's cooked this way because it is tzli, it's shulchan malachim. That's the way it's put. That it has to be al shulchan malachim. What will be on the king's plate? And the king's plate will be a steak. And it will be grilled. Right? So to here, the idea is that we're celebrating our freedom, right? When they're being freed, they're looking at themselves in the best possible light. This is an unbelievable experience for them.
Or it's a preparation for freedom, something that they've never had before.
Well, this is the real moment when they're transitioning from slavery to freedom. The entire purpose of the Karban Pesach, kind of like what Irit was pointing out, was now they're breaking free of their captors. Beforehand, when you're a slave, the last thing you're going to do is, you know, slaughter their gods and eat them, right? Yeah. That's the last thing you're going to do. When you're doing that publicly, then you're making a statement. And that and this was that's why this was such a test. This was a test for them. Are they ready to do this? Are they psychologically able to say the Egyptians are no longer our masters, Hashem is our master? God gives them a commandment. It goes completely against their inclinations, right? Their mindset. So that this is the biggest, they're breaking free fully, psychologically. Because after this 10th plague, it's going to be a very quick process until they leave. They have to prove themselves, and they have to prove themselves to themselves. So when they're taking that blood and putting it on the doorpost, it's not just hocus pocus, right? They're literally taking the blood of their God and putting it on their door and just saying, that's, you know, what are you going to do about it?
And you're trusting Hashem, because that, like, this plague is probably like the worst in terms of severity.
Right.
And so you're doing this and putting your trust in Hashem, almost like Abraham did with Yaakov, like of saying, I'm going to trust so much that I know, like by putting the blood here, I'm, you know, not going to be subject to this really harsh thing.
Right, exactly. So by breaking free of the Egyptians, Hashem will now save them because now they're showing I am not like them. But if they don't put the blood on the doorpost, Hashem is saying, how can I differentiate between one house and the next? Neither one of them really believe in me. Neither one of them are really ready to be my people. So how can I differentiate
one from the other? So for the Jews who didn't put the blood on their doorpost, they didn't leave Egypt.
Well, their firstborns died.
Mm-hmm. But were they allowed to leave Egypt? Would the rest of the community?
Would the rest of the people in that family mm-hmm. be allowed to leave Egypt?
Yes, if they survive, they're leaving.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess if they survive, they're leaving.
So even
yeah.
if they didn't believe.
But they just lost. But they just lost their old. They just lost their child. It's not exactly. You know, they all had to make this decision. You know, going in. Okay. So maybe this is kind of the way I was looking at this. This is what I was thinking. So I was thinking, if we're going to look at the Karban Pesach as the best of the best, okay. It represents purely, unambiguously, the good side, the good times, the exodus, not the slavery side. There's nothing about the Karban Pesach that really represents slavery. It's all freedom, right? They weren't eating this when they were slaves. They weren't doing this when they were slaves. This is pure freedom, okay? So if it's going to be representing the, you know, kind of the extreme freedom, the best of the best, so maybe now it makes sense why it's only done in the Beis HaMikdash. Because maybe the Karban Pesach has to be done only in the best of circumstances, right? It's supposed to represent the Jewish people at their best, right? Our people, our nation, at their best, in the best possible circumstances. Maybe it's intentionally set up in a way that it can't be done second rate. It can't be done in less than ideal conditions, right? And that's why it's specifically only done in the Beis HaMikdash, just only can be done then. And when we don't have the Beis HaMikdash and we don't have the Karban Pesach, it's supposed to be very evident that our freedom is lacking, that our circumstances are lacking. We're not where we should be. That's built into the Karban Pesach, that message. That without the, when we have the Karban Pesach, it's letting us know now we're fully free. Now we are where we're supposed to be. But we don't have it. It's a subtle message that things are not 100%. We weren't meant to be here. We were meant to be back in Israel. We're meant to be with the Beis HaMikdash. And we don't have it, so therefore there's no Karban Pesach. So maybe if you're looking at it that way, then it seems to make a little bit of sense. Which brings us to the next question, right? So why is it that when it comes to the Pesach Seder, that we don't eat any roasted meat? Why don't we represent the Karban Pesach with roasted meat instead of matzah? Well, two answers. Number one, why could matzah be viewed as a good replacement for the Karban Pesach?
Because it's half good time.
Right, because it's at least representing this part of matzah represents the leaving Egypt. Mm-hmm. So it actually, of everything that we have at the Seder, it makes the most sense, because there's a real aspect of matzah that's talking about leaving Egypt. Right? More than any other thing we have at the Seder, suddenly Mara wouldn't be any good. And to just get random meat, but the random meat doesn't have any symbolism to it. It's not intrinsically about freedom, then it's just meat. If it's not a Korban Pesach, then it's just meat. And just meat is not really, is missing the whole point. We need to have this, right? We need to have the matzah, because that's at least half of it represents leaving Egypt. And if we have meat that's not the Korban Pesach, so maybe then we are missing the point. If part of the point of the Korban Pesach is that we're supposed to miss it when it's not there, because it's supposed to tell us that our freedom is lacking, so if we try to pretend we have it, we're missing that message altogether. Right? If the point of the Korban Pesach is we only have this Korban Pesach when we're in ideal conditions, because it's the ideal mitzvah, it's supposed to be the mitzvah that represents us at our best, so we can't fake it. We can't pretend to have other meat. Oh, look, it's like we have the Korban Pesach. No, we're supposed to miss it. It's supposed to be different. We're supposed to look at the matzah and say, this isn't the Korban Pesach. I want my steak. I don't want this, right? So maybe those two reasons are why it ends up being that the Afikomen ends up being the best way that we can replace the Korban Pesach, even though it seems to be a kind of a funny mix. Any questions on this?
What I understand, I believe, and the way I learned them, that the reason they had matzah, because they didn't have time for the bread to raise.
Right.
So, how did the day before had the matzah?
What do you mean?
The day before.
Perfect question, exactly. I mean, how do they have the matzah to eat the Korban Pesach? Right. How do they even know what matzah is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the point. The point is, what do you think they ate when they were slaves? They ate matzah.
Why did they tell me differently?
Perhaps it's that they didn't have any left when they left Egypt.
No, well, meaning when they're slaves, the Egyptians aren't baking them fresh baked bread, right? You're getting the matzah's quick, right? Matzah's quick. You can mass produce it. You can get it out. It's filling. You know what? Give the slaves the food and move them on, right? We're not a restaurant here. When they're leaving Egypt, they're looking forward to baking the. Why are they baking bread when they're leaving Egypt? Am I asking the question?
Because they're
free. Right? Because they're free. Now we can bake bread, right? Think about that. They're running out now. Like, wait a second. I'm going to wait for my bread. Get out of here. What are you baking bread for? We didn't have time to let the bread rot. What are you even baking bread? You're baking bread because you can. Because now you can. Now you don't have to eat the stupid matzah anymore, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that now, the thing that represented slavery in the beginning, now represents freedom. Now we have to have matzah because we have to get out of here so fast. It's the same bread. Mm-hmm. It's the same matzah. But now you look at it completely different. Right?
That's why they just a certain time the matzah has to be there when it was baked, no?
What do you mean?
I think there is a time limit. How long the matzah can stay?
Yeah, 18 minutes is the maximum of bake, so it's still matzah, it doesn't rise too much. Right. Right, exactly. So that's the whole purpose of the matzah. The reason they know what matzah is now, when they're eating the Korban, when they're eating the Pesach meal, is because that's what they've been eating. They know very well what matzah is. God doesn't have to remind them, right?
Okay. So matzah represents almost like their past and their future.
Exactly. Right. That's what makes it such an interesting part. That's why it's such a central component of the Seder, right? Because if all you have is matzah's about we had to rush when we left Egypt, that seems a very inconsequential part of the story to be the central focus of the entire Seder. Okay, so they had to rush. Okay, but that's now, it's Chag HaMatzot, it's the holiday of Matzot. But if you look at it this way, no, they ate matzah as slaves, and they ate matzah when they were free, but now the same thing represents something totally different. That symbolism is much stronger. That's very strong. So that's why the matzah is supposed to do both at the same time. And that's why we have the Afikomen, because it does at least represent that freedom. Okay.
They were also traveling. They were getting ready for travel in the desert. And, you know, when you go camping, you don't particularly bring challahs with you. You bring crackers.
Right, you bring sentences.
Yeah,
although
you bring dry provisions.
Although the wine stacks did the most brilliant thing, and they did like a week driving trip. You know, they went down to like L.A. Grand Canyon. They went through like all the national parks. You know, so they didn't like, you know, camp. You know, stay in a motel or something. They brought a bread maker with them. It's brilliant because it's a bread maker. Have some basic supplies, and every day you have fresh bread. If you're in places where you can't really get kosher food, brilliant. Every day, make a different one. You make a chocolate one, or this one, that one. That's brilliant. Yeah, exactly.
So you meet
well, but what?
You flour know? And water and yeast.
Right, that's all you need. That's well, the water you can get anywhere, right? You just need the flour. Yeah. That's easy.
We just didn't think of it when we were leaving Egypt, you know.
Well, they didn't have bread machines.
Where
am I going to plug this in?
What do you mean?
But that's why we got manna, which was like even better than.
Right.
We just didn't plan it.
Well, we didn't plan ahead, obviously.
We're in a hurry.
All right. There's one other very interesting aspect of the Karban Pesach that I'll just key on as well. Is that it's also very family-oriented. We talked about how the one thing we don't maintain from this story is how, is the blood in the doorposts. But it's not 100% true, because the mitzvah was to eat the Karban Pesach as a, in a family grouping, right? You couldn't eat it on your own. You had to, if you didn't have a family, you know, like, we'll assign one for you. That kind of situation, right? You had to get part of a group. And even if you're like two families living in a house, they had to be separated in some meaningful way. They couldn't look at each other. Each group had to eat it on their own. Now, it's interesting, when they were slaughtering the Karban Pesach, each person would bring their animal, and they would make sure as many people as possible would be part of the process of, you know, different people would hold it, different people would help. They wanted a communal feel when they did the Karban Pesach. Everyone was doing it together. And here actually is where we get the concept of Berov Am Hadras Melech, that the more people who are involved, the better it is. Right? So it wasn't just every individual did it on their own. Everyone, it was this whole elaborate procedure, and everyone would be helping each other. They set it up that you'd have to help other people. But when it came to actually eating it, you had to eat it as a family. And that goes directly back to this story. Each family's huddled up in their house, right? You're getting ready to leave, and we saw that the part of the commandment was you have to be dressed, you have to have your staff ready, right? The Egyptians are going to ask you to leave, so you got to be ready to go. But where are they? They're all huddled up in their houses, by themselves, listening to the screams out there, and they only have each other for support. So the Karban Pesach and the Seder. It's interesting how this works, but the Seder really has maintained that, right? It's still very much a familiar you'll feel. And even, you know, if you go to these big hotels, it's still every table has their own Seder, for the most part. Some are a few together. Actually, when we did our communal Seder, I tried to kind of maintain that somewhat, that it was a communal Seder, but every table had, you know, a chance to really be their own table as well. Because I think that's a big part of what the Seder is about. It's each grouping, each family is on their own. So that's maintained here. You know, we don't have the blood in the doorpost anymore. But we do have this feel that, okay, this is a family together time. Right? No matter who you are, where you are, Pesach is the time that you're supposed to be together as a family.
Where is that came from? There is a stranger at the table.
I'm sorry?
When it came in that there is a stranger has to be, or somebody out of the family.
Well, we invite people in. Right? Well, we invite people in.
Oh, I see.
I mean, that's an Aramaic, so that's actually a later mention. But it makes sense because for the Karban Pesach as well, let's say you had someone who was single, they're on their own.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Someone had to take them in. You had to take them in. Mm. Right? They couldn't do it on their own. So that was the idea. They became part of a chabura. They became part of a group. So I think that also kind of goes back to the beginning. You know, everyone's got to be together. Everyone wants to be together. No one wants to be by themselves the night when the 10th plague was happening.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody, you know, it
and
was.
Outside, everybody's screaming.
Right. Everyone was huddled together, right? If you've ever been in a situation, I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but
Hurricane Andrew?
Yeah, I think back to Hurricane Andrew, which I was, you know, sitting in my house with my family, and we're hulled up, and we have our, you know, all electricity's knocked out, and you just hear these whooshes and this rain and all this stuff happening outside, and you're just like, you're just together, and you have no idea what's really happening out there, but you're just kind of hulled up together, and
should have stayed in New Jersey.
That's what happened.
We had hurricanes in New Jersey too. I think it was Gloria or something.
1938, that was a big one.
Yeah. The 80s. Yeah.
It happens every time you have a disaster. I don't remember the 89 earthquake here.
I remember it.
You don't remember? You were here?
I wasn't here, but I remember it happening. Yeah.
You don't experience it here.
Right, exactly. So I'm sure, I feel the earthquake is different because everyone's, I guess you stay held up, no? You're not really running.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't get out.
You don't go anywhere. Well, yeah, that makes sense.
It happened 20 seconds when it was over.
Right.
Yeah, but often the electricity is knocked out.
Yeah.
It's hard to go anyplace. Nothing's open.
Right, there, you deal with the aftermath. The hurricane, you're dealing with hours of the storm coming through.
That's what's nice about earthquakes. They're fast.
There was no electricity. There was nothing. No, you couldn't drive. You couldn't.
You could drive.
There were no traffic lights.
You stop at every street corner.
Well, and there was a mess.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I didn't experience that. But so anyway, that's the other part of the Karban Pesach, is that you have that as well. So you have both the aspect of it being kind of the...
But also, you know, on 9/11, there was a very similar experience. People stayed home.
But you didn't know.
Sure. Happening. Yeah. Sir?
Like, a lot of people didn't know that it happened. Mm. I was walking to work. But anyway, besides the point.
Because where it happened in the East Coast, it was 6 o'clock over here.
And I didn't find... Well, it didn't turn out that day, so I didn't know until 5 o'clock.
I didn't know
that anything happened.
I didn't know I was until 7 here. Because 6:30 was show, and people were saying...
I was in Israel, so
it was, I don't listen to the radio in the morning. I go to show.
Right.
It was about 9:30 local time here. Yeah.